Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars, Planet of Twilight by Barbara Hambly. The first to die was a midshipman named Koth Barak. One of his fellow crew members on the New Republic escort cruiser Adamantine found him slumped across the table in the Deck 9 break room, where he'd gone half an hour previously for a cup of coffee. 20 minutes after Barak should have been back to post, Gunnery Sergeant Galley Wover went looking for him, certain that he'd clicked into the infolog banks just to see if anybody mentions the mission. Of course nobody was going to mention the mission. Though Chief of State Leia Organa Solo was accompanied by the Adamantine, her journey to the Meridian Sector was an entirely unofficial one. The Rites of Sentience party would have argued, quite correctly, that Seti Ashgad, the man she was to meet at the rendezvous point just outside the Koryos systems, held no official position on his home world of Nam Koryos. To arrange an official conference would be to give tacit approval to his and the Rationalist Party's demands. Which was, when it came down to it, the reason for the talks. When Sergeant Wover saw the young man, head on the break table, eyes shut, she called to him. No response. She pecked the commander's code on the wall panel. Sir? Wover here. One of the midshipmen's down. The meds haven't gotten here yet, but... No, sir, I don't know what it is, but you might want to check with Her Excellency's flagship and let them know. Within moments, the med droids arrived and began pumping stimulants and anti-shock into the boy's veins. Wover could see the initial diagnostic lines on the screens. No virus, no bacteria, no poison. No foreign material in Koth Barak's body at all. The lines dipped steadily toward zero, then went flat. Seti Ashgad turned from the bubble of the observation viewport to regard the woman who sat coolly watchful in one of the lounge's gray leather chairs.
"We have a complicated situation on Nam Koryos, Your Excellency."
"We? Meaning whom, Master Ashgad?" Leia Organa Solo was a petite, almost fragile-looking woman. Her relative youth would have surprised anyone who didn't know that from the age of 17 she'd been heavily involved in the rebellion, spearheaded by her father and the great stateswoman Mon Mothma. The inhabitants of Nam Koryos? Or only some of them?
All of them.
Ashgad stood close to her, trying to dominate her with his height. But she looked up at him with an expression that told him she knew exactly what he was trying to do, and he stepped back.
"All of us," he corrected himself. "Newcomers and Therans alike."
Leia folded her hands on her knee, the wide velvet sleeves and voluminous skirts of her crimson ceremonial robe picking up the soft sheen of the lamps overhead. Once she would have remarked tartly that he was omitting mention of the largest segment of the planet's population. Those who were neither the technological post-imperial newcomers nor the ragged Theran cultists who haunted the cold and waterless wastes, but ordinary farmers. Now she gave him silence, waiting to see what else he would say. Ashgad continued in the rich baritone that so closely resembled the recording she had heard of his father.
"I should explain that Nam Koryos is a barren and hostile world. Without massive technology, it is literally not possible to make a living there."
Leia looked at him skeptically. "The political prisoners sent to Nam Koryos by the Grismath dynasty seem to have managed for the past 700 years.
"Ah, I see Your Excellency has studied the history of the sector."
He tried to sound pleased. "Enough to know that the Grismath shipped their political prisoners there in the hopes that they'd starve to death and set automated gun stations all over the planet to keep them from being rescued. I know that the prisoners not only didn't oblige them by dying, but that their descendants and the descendants of the guards are still farming the planet, while the Grismuth homeworld is itself just a ball of charred radioactive waste. The only reason Leia knew this much about Namkorios was that her father had once observed that Emperor Palpatine seemed to be using the world for its original purpose, as a prison. 40 years ago, it had been rumored that the elder Seti Ashgad had been stranded on the isolated planet by agents of his political foe, then-Senator Palpatine. Those rumors had remained unproven until this second Ashgad had made contact with the Council in the wake of the squabbling on the planet and asked to be heard. "Do not meet with Ashgat," said the message that had reached Leia literally as she was preparing to board the shuttle to take her to her flagship. "Do not trust him or accede to any demand that he makes." Leia went on, "I understood that the only inhabitants of the planet before recolonization recommenced after the fall of the Empire were descendants of the original prisoners and their guards." From a corner of the lounge, in the shadow of a dark-leaved dianthus vine, Ashgad's secretary Zim smiled. Leia wasn't sure what to make of her aversion to Zim. A small brown-skinned man with his black hair drawn up into a smooth topknot. It might be the looseness of his mouth or the flattened-looking tan eyes that never seemed to blink. She forced herself to look directly at him. "Are you one of the original Koryans, Master Zim?" He said, "My ancestors were among those sent to Namkorios by the Grismuths. Yes, Your Excellency." Something changed in his eyes, becoming preoccupied as if all his attention were suddenly directed elsewhere. Ashgard went on hastily, as if covering the other man's lapse.
"The problem, Your Excellency, is that 750 years of complete isolation has made the old-timer population of Namkorios into an iron-bound set of fanatical conservatives. You and I both know how that makes for superstition. One of the things my father tried to institute was a modern clinic in Wegshall. The farmers would rather take their sick to some Theran cult listener to be healed with power sucked down out of the air." He leaned forward confidingly. "It isn't only the newcomers that the Rationalist Party is trying to help, Your Excellency. It's the farmers themselves. Unless something is done to wrest control of the old Grismuth gun stations away from the Theran cultists, who forbid any kind of interplanetary trade, these people are going to continue to live like the agricultural slaves they once were. There's a strong Rationalist Party on Namkorios. And it's growing stronger. We want planetary trade with the New Republic. We want technology and proper exploitation of the planet's resources. Is that so harmful?"
Leia raised an eyebrow. "The majority of the planet's inhabitants think it is."
Ashgat gestured furiously. "The majority of the planet's inhabitants have been brainwashed by half a dozen lunatics who get loaded on Bruckneal route and wander around the wasteland having conversations with rocks."
Leia glanced out the port, which offered a spectacular view of the ice-green and lavender curve of Bruckness Koryos, whose largest moon had been designated as the orbital rendezvous of the secret meeting. The escort cruiser Adamantine was just visible. Below it, close to the bright triangle of colored stars that were the primaries of Brocknus, Nam, and Peduceus Koryos, and pathetically tiny against the cruiser's bulk, hung the cluster of linked bronze hulls that was Seti Ashgad's vessel, the Light of Reason. Even Leia's flagship, the Borealis, dwarfed it. Assembled of such small craft as could slip singly through the watchful screens of Namkorios' ancient defensive installations, the light would barely have served as a planet hopper. It could never have taken a hyperspace jump. Hence, Leia thought uneasily, this mission. Even before she'd had the surreptitious message, their distance from the nearest New Republic bases on Doran and their proximity to the one-time Imperial satrapy of the Anti-Meridian sector made her nervous. Seti Ashgad paced restlessly.
"It isn't just that we newcomers are forbidden to bring in any ships larger than a personal flitter, or to let any out. The Theran habit of opening fire on any vessel over a certain size means that when equipment wears out, it can't be replaced except for an exorbitant fee. You can't pretend that's fair."
Leia spoke slowly.
I'm not saying that the Therans are right. But isn't that what colonization is all about? Gambling on what conditions are going to be when you get there? She held up a hand as the man before her drew breath for an indignant protest. What I am saying is that the Therans are supported by the majority of the population of the planet. Seti Ashgad erupted. Who are kept as their slaves by superstition and lies. That isn't the Republic's business. Namkorios is not a part of the Republic. Legally, we have no right to interfere in their affairs. Leia paused for a moment. What I will do is this. When I return to Coruscant, I'll authorize an investigation team to see what's really going on down on the planet. We may be able to negotiate with the Therans who control the gun stations. Ashgad rose.
I had hoped to convince you to come to our aid, Your Excellency. I'll certainly use all the influence I possess in the newcomer community to help your commission.
He bowed and left, accompanied by Zim, his trio of bodyguards, handsome androgynes with the oddly dead-looking hair of very expensive dolls, bowed as well. As she watched the bronze-embossed doors shut behind them, Leia heard a soft, gravelly whisper behind her.
Those three smell wrong, lady. They are no living flesh.
Leia glanced behind her at the four small, gray, wrinkled humanoids, who seemed to have melted from the antechamber's walls. The smallest, who barely topped Leia's elbow, regarded the bronze doors with narrowed yellow eyes. Several years had passed since, in the face of mounting pressure from the Council, Leia had eliminated her bodyguard of Nogri hunter-killers. There were those who said it ill-behooved her to wield a weapon that had been Palpatine's. Do not trust Ashgad, the message had said. She had sent for the Nogri secretly just before departure. There were some risks greater than schism in the Council. She answered thoughtfully, Technically, it is living flesh, though. They're synth droids, Ezrak. Sculpted synth flesh over metal armatures. They have only minimal internal computers. Their actions are centrally controlled, probably from Ashgad's ship. She frowned. Would you make sure for me that they do get on their vessel? The Nogri withdrew. They tended to keep separate from the Academy Honor Guard, who were among the few even aware of their presence on the ship. As Luke would say, there was no telling which group might be her salvation in a crisis. Do not meet with Ashgad. Down on the Borealis shuttle deck, Luke Skywalker turned the slip of flimsoplast that held that strange message over in his hands. The handwriting was Callista's. His heart was a slow battering ram against his ribs. The astromech droid R2-D2 had emerged from around the airfoil of the modified B-Wing. C-3PO, protocol droid extraordinaire, followed close behind, golden carapace shining in the soft light. 3PO announced, According to R2, all systems appear to be in flying order, Master Luke. But personally, I should be much happier were you to take a larger craft with greater oxygen capacity. Luke nodded absently. Thanks, 3PO. But his attention never left the slip of plast in his hand. He was seeing the snows of Hoth, and the way Callista's lightsaber had vied with the ice planet's dim sunlight for brightness. Remembering what it had been to fight at her side, more a part of him than his own hand. With the memories of the snow were the warm scents of night on Yavin 4, and of lying in each other's arms on the hillside above the jungles, counting stars. He hurt with wanting her, missing her, needing her. He remembered the blazing glare of the huge ships and the renegade Admiral Dalla's fleet crashing in flames. His own voice crying Callista's name, and her voice, I have my own odyssey. The message had arrived in a music box. Analysis of the peculiar crystalline dust beneath the nailheads had revealed that it had been put together on Namkorios. Callista was on Namkorios. 3PO urged Luke back to the present. Can I be of further assistance, Master Luke? According to my internal chronometers, Her Excellency's meeting with Master Ashgad should be concluding now, and you did express a desire to be away from the Borealis before Master Ashgad returns to the shuttle bay. Luke nodded. Right. Thank you, both of you. Good luck, Master Luke.
Given an estimated population of less than 1 million humans and no indigenous life forms on Nam Kurios, chances of locating Lady Callista within a standard year should be well within the 17th percentile.
Luke made himself smile. Thanks. It had been a year already since the Night Hammer had plunged blazing into the atmosphere of Yavin 4, and Callista had decided to reforge her connection with the Force on her own. Luke was turning toward the ladder that led up to the B-Wing's hatch when the main bay doors opened. His sister entered, golden boot tips flashing beneath her crimson gown. So, did he whip out an ion cannon and try to murder you?
I sympathize with his cause, but it's out of our jurisdiction.
They spoke briefly of the inconclusive meeting as Luke prepared to leave. Then he spoke softly.
Callista's got to come back. She'll stand a better chance of regaining her ability to use the Force at the Jedi Academy than she will on her own. The Jedi power still has to be within her. Kray had it. It isn't as if Callista's mind went into the body of a non-Jedi. And the Academy needs her.
Leia was silent, and he added,
I need her.
She nodded sympathetically.
You'd better go. And Luke, when you're down there, look around, will you?
According to Ashgad, the Theran cultists who control the gun stations use coercion and superstition to rule the old-timer population. If it is just superstition, there's nothing we can do about that. They voted overwhelmingly to keep the original trade restrictions in force. But if there's coercion involved, that may change the rationalist's case. Moff Gitelli still rules the Anti-Meridian sector in the name of the Emperor, so he says. If fighting breaks out between the newcomers and the Therans, he may try to interfere. We've got a pretty strong force at the Duran orbital base, but I'd rather not have to use it. I wish you could at least take R2 with you. He climbed the few rungs of the ladder up the airfoil. So do I, but even if I took him apart and tucked the pieces into every corner and under the seat of this thing, there wouldn't be room. Her last sight of the bay showed her Luke's B-Wing turning with weightless grace to the steadily burning violet eye of the distant world where Callista had taken her refuge. Alone in her private parlor, Leia idly studied an ad cube from the Lorinar Corporation Synthroid Division concerning the new droids that several members of the Council were eager to buy.
Hardly droids at all,
the pleasant voice of an obviously Synthroid announcer lauded. Suddenly, she leaned her head against the back of the chair, tired beyond words. Tired, she thought as her hands and feet grew cold. Beyond what she should be. Every breath was an effort. The hand she tried to raise to rub the ache behind her sternum felt as if it had been manacled with lead. Dizziness swamped her. She reached across the table for the comm button, but collapsed halfway and slid to the floor. The door swished open and 3PO toddled into the stateroom, R2 close on his heels.
Your Excellency, I have been attempting to monitor fleet communications and... Your Excellency!
The stateroom door slid open again, framing the small form of Zim.
Oh, Master Zim, something terrible has happened. You must inform the emergency services.
The man walked to Leia's side. Then he half-knelt and began to pull off his violet leather gloves. Again the door swished open, and Ashgad entered, accompanied by one of the fair-haired androgynous synthroids.
Zim, release her, now!
Zim's mouth turned pettishly down. Then he drew a little breath.
Very well. The action is stopped.
Ashgad picked up Leia, limp in his arms, the red velvet robes hanging nearly to the floor. To the synthroid he began to say,
You're to wait until the brig is... Yes, Lygius.
A thin, tired-looking man who was the brig's pilot stepped in.
I've launched the slave relay with the time-delayed projections of final reports for both vessels. The messages should be indistinguishable from real transmissions. Everyone on board both ships appears to be dead or incapacitated. The synth droids have taken one of the shuttles over to the escort ship.
Ashgad glanced at the wall chronometer.
Very good. It should take about 30 minutes for us to return to the Light of Reason and take her far enough from these ships for safety.
Oh, R2, do something, cried 3PO. We have to stop them. Guards, guards, they are kidnapping the chief of state.
The three men brushed past 3PO and R2, impervious to the droid's protestations, Leia unconscious in Ashgad's arms.
Shuttle bay, cried 3PO, punching the code on the wall comm. Shuttle bay, they must be stopped.
There was no answer.
Where is everyone? R2, we must get help.
The door opened as they turned to enter the anteroom. Through it, 3PO could glimpse the Nogri Ezrak, sprawled on the floor, still moving feebly, but his face livid with the pallor of approaching death. Others, human and Nogri, lay on the floor beyond. R2 directed a scanner beam over the closest body.
I know, you stupid bucket of bolts. They're all dead.
The Force was everywhere, palpable. Leia lay on a divan, on the toothed fist-sized crystals that carpeted the old sea floor plains as far as vision could descry. And she basked in the Force so much warmer than the heatless fingernail of the sun. She dreamed. She was in her father's palace in Aldera. She was presenting her children to him. Jason, Jaina, and Anakin were all grown to teenagers.
What have you taught them, these young Jedi of the House of Organa?
I've taught them to respect the rights of all living things. I've taught them that the law is above any single being's will. But we know better. Anakin spoke in the breaking treble of an adolescent, and there was an ugly grin on his face as he stepped forward. We're Jedi Knights. We have the power. His lightsaber licked out crimson and slashed her father in half. All three children had drawn lightsabers, gleaming red columns of power, making six red flames in three pairs of demon eyes. We're Jedi, Mother, said Jaina. There's no law for us. We can do whatever we want. That's your gift to us, said Anakin. We're Jedi, because you're Jedi. We are what you are. He turned to look at the pieces of Bail Organa's body. And anyway, he wasn't your real father. Leia screamed.
No! No!
The images blurred to darkness, and she heard Luke's voice.
Learn to use the Force, Leia. You have to.
Never!
You have to.
She could not move. And then, as she struggled to make sense of what was happening to her, she remembered a pilot for the rebel forces who had talked to her one night about the many substances he was addicted to. One, called Sweet Blossom, he had spoken of almost caressingly.
A little of it. Two drops, maybe. And it's like you've just woken up before your mind is in gear to do anything. You just sit around in your pajamas saying, I'll take care of business when I'm feeling a bit more the thing. But of course, you never do. Five drops is good for endless sitting, watching addercops spin webs or dust motes make patterns. Seven or eight drops, and you're paralyzed.
She heard the door lock unbolting and the rustle of clothing just beyond the line of her sight. She tried to turn her head and couldn't. Panic flooded her. Sweet Blossom, she thought. Someone was approaching the divan on which she lay. The divan's legs scraped on the permacrete floor as it was drawn backwards, away from the rectangle of sunlight that came through a tall, transparisteel panel. Every atom of Leia's body struggled to rise, to fight, at least to turn her head. Zim came around the head of the divan. He stood gazing down at her. She saw that the skin of his throat was purplish-brown, shiny, and slightly articulated. Chitinous. Not like human skin at all. He walked around behind her. Lifting aside her hair, he put his hands to her neck. Something sliced her that wasn't pain and wasn't cold. More terrifying than either. She sank into darkness. As Luke touched the levers of the B-Wing and accelerated into high orbit over Namkorios, a surge of the Force washed over him. No wonder Callisto was drawn to this place, he thought. Now the planet was clearly visible. Wastes of slate, smooth and hard, stretched kilometer after kilometer. Zones of broken rock surrounded them, toothed mountains uneroded by rain or the roots of growing plants. In other places, the dry sea floors were covered for thousands of miles in faceted quartzine gravel that glared as if the world were one great cut-glass gem. Crystal mountains flashed a bleached and broken reflection in the wan light of the tiny, faded, whitish sun. He brought up the coordinates for the town of Huegshal. He would find her. He thought he would see her again. A long-range laser cannon took out his rear deflector shield and nicked the stabilizer before he was even out of sight of blackness and stars. Luke flipped into evasive action, plunging toward that glittering eternity of crystal through a flaming howl of atmosphere. A second bolt clipped the B-wing's airfoil, and as he fought to pull out of the crazy spin, Luke saw white lances of light slash upward from the slate-gray foothills. The ground rushed upward. Blast, thought Luke as the joystick lurched under his hands. Don't quit on me now. There was enough play in the remaining stabilizer to land without killing himself, just. But when he leveled off, he'd be a better target. He zagged right, left. Dropped instinctively as a beam sliced over his head. Those were live gunners. They had to be. No auto station had that kind of response flexibility. Huge mountains yawned below him. He plunged the fighter down among them, veered through narrowing chasms. As a laser bolt splintered a black column of rock 1,000 feet high and rained the craft with fragments. The steady howling winds of the higher atmosphere turned to random hurricanes that smote him from every canyon and crevice. Luke pulled into a level slide, barely avoiding another bolt and a crag of striated quartz, the glare of the sunlight from a million mirrors nearly blinding. He put out all the strength of the force to lift the B-wing over the last ridge of shining glass and edge it down, down. Wind slapped him like a monster hand. The B-wing veered wildly. Then the airfoil scraped and tore on the pebbled wilderness beyond the canyon. There was an explosion of sealant and crash foam. The B-wing rolled and came to a stop against something that sent up a cloud of fragments and dust. Here, Your Excellency. Strong hands helped Leia sit up, put a cup into hers, held it steady while she drank. How are you feeling? She blinked. The divan had been moved out onto the terrace that adjoined the room. She could see the small sun, giving only thready light in cobalt oceans of sky. Dim stars shone, even in the presence of its glow. She found that she could move her head and turn from those bizarre distances to meet the anxious, dark eyes of the man who sat at her side.
Where am I? What happened?
I'm afraid I can't tell you, Your Excellency. He sounded genuinely sorry about it. You understand, it's better if you don't know. My name is Lygia Sarpatius Vaughn.
You were Seti Ashgard's pilot, weren't you?
Zim was here.
Is this Namkorios?
Zim was here. He held the vessel away from her reaching hands, his dark brows knotting. I think you've had enough of this, Your Excellency. I'll get you some water. He emptied the cup, which Leia thought had contained water, over the low wall at the edge of the terrace. Lygia spoke gently.
Stay here, in the sunshine. I won't be a moment.
Voices rose to her from below. She recognized Seti Ashgard's.
We'd just have to go over Larm's head and talk to Demura. Larm's an idiot, anyway. He still has no concept of what we need to complete the Reliant.
Larm, thought Leia. Moff Gitelli's had an admiral named Larm. She couldn't make out the words murmured in reply, but the purring voice pierced her. Zim. Soreness lingered on the sides of her neck, but she lacked the strength to put her hands up to feel. Ashgard answered,
3 synth droids, when I think about how much even one of those things costs.
Zim's voice was a little louder now.
It could not be helped, my lord.
Synth droids were the only way we could bring the Death Seed on board the vessels undetected.
The Death Seed? Leia's breath left her as if with physical shock. Hundreds of years ago, that plague had wiped out millions.
It was the casualness of Zim's tone that galvanized her into action. She rose from the divan and made her way shakily to the far end of the terrace, perhaps 25 meters below, just above where the walls of the great rambling house merged into the harsh basalt of the bluff. Another terrace ran the length of the building. A sort of gazebo stood at one end. By the way Ashgad turned, Leia guessed that Zim sat within the gazebo's shade. A complex system of mist jets and pipes somewhat mitigated the dryness of the air. There was a third being on the terrace, stretched out on a black and orange air duvet under a veritable rain shower of air misters.
Zim's right.
It rolled over, flexed its jellied length. It was the longest hut Leia had ever seen without Jabba's obesity.
You couldn't have gotten past the medical scans without them. And only droids would have taken the vessels into hyperspace without a second jump coordinate.
Hyperspace, Leia thought in alarm. Her crew, her honor guard, 3PO and R2.
Sickness and horror swept her, replaced a moment later by a burning rage. The hut was saying,
Demura thought it was worth the expenditure. I agree with him. It wasn't enough to have Lygius put through that mission accomplished. We're leaving for Coruscant message. Or even the fake transmissions from the jump point. What do you care anyway? Demura paid for the synth droids, not you.
Ashgad turned impatiently from the railing to face the huge reclining shape.
With an attitude like that, it's no wonder you're no longer ruling this territory, Beldorian.
The hut rumbled.
Anyway, what's 300,000 credits, if you can get rid of all evidence of where Her Excellency is? Once Riakin goes into a coma, the Council's going to be chasing its tail for days, each member trying to keep the next from being named successor.
Minister Riakin, her second in command in the Council.
The hut produced a burp of cosmic proportions.
And don't speak to me about not ruling this force-benighted planet anymore. I ruled here longer than your petty empire existed, and I ruled well.
He extended one hand,
and Leia felt it. The force.
All around, the air changed as if the iridescent sunlight had become swirling, angry.
Beldorian, the hut, had been trained as a Jedi.
Leia's knees felt weak, and she retreated to the divan.
She had the Death Seed. I have to warn Riakin. I have to warn someone.
The sweet blossom drug whispered its reply.
Of course you do. But not just now.
As she lay down, something in the pocket of her robe pressed into her thigh, hard and uncomfortable. Leia frowned. Clumsy with the effects of the sweet blossom, her fingers closed on metal.
It was her lightsaber.
Leia forced herself into wakefulness. Before Lygius came back, she thought she'd better check out her room for whatever escape she could find. The air was softer indoors, modified to escape the piercing dryness. That meant magnetic shields on the doors and some kind of mist generators in the ceilings. The massive walls sheltered a sour muskiness that no air conditioning could disperse. Any place a hut occupied smelled of hut, of course. There were bugs, too. Tiny and purplish-brown, skittering along the shadows at the base of the wall. Then Seti Ashgad's voice rose again, and she returned to the terrace.
Lygius told me you'd visited her. You're to leave her alone.
She is a Jedi, Lord. I was only seeking to keep her under control.
I know what you were seeking to do. The Sweet Blossom will keep her under control without help from you. We can't take the chance of the Council naming a successor. Until everything is accomplished, let her alone.
And then?
There was a long silence. And then, we'll see. Luke hung for several minutes in the seat restraint, getting his breath.
Part of his mind he stretched out to the Force, manipulating the power of fusion and heat to keep the small impulse fuel reserves from exploding. Another part he extended, listening, probing across the harsh landscape for signs of danger. People were on their way. His mind picked up the radiant buzz of hostility. Theran fanatics, almost certainly. He couldn't get purchase on his blaster in time to free it before the weight of springing bodies rocked the fighter. Shadows fell across the gaps in the buckled hull as he snaked his arm free, sprang to his feet, and slithered through a split in the side of the tiny cockpit. Moments before, expanding gas percussive weapons echoed like thunder, and a shower of high-velocity stone pellets spattered the space where he had been. There were a lot of attackers, 20 or 25, Luke estimated, dropping to the gravel, men and women. In the sharp cold, they were wrapped in thick vests and jackets, sometimes covered by ragged burnouses. In addition to the scatter guns, they had bows, both auto bows and primitive longbows, and short javelins, and they surrounded the wrecked B-wing completely. There are 1,000 ways to use the Force in a fight, Callista's old master Jin had told her, and 1,001 ways to use the Force to avoid a fight. Luke now used something Jin had taught Callista and she him. His mind jarred the gravel underfoot, and the gravel coughed forth dust. A lot of dust. Luke launched himself out of the shelter of the B-wing, making for the Theran speeders and riding beasts amid a roar of gunfire and a rain of projectiles. The speeders were as grubby a collection of 5th-gen makeshift junkers as Luke had seen this side of the Rebellion's worst days. Prancing and yammering among them were a dozen Koopas, brightly hued, hot-weather cousins of Tauntaun. Luke flung himself into the best-looking of the speeders and slammed it into gear. More dust bellied up, engulfing the Therans, who rushed from the first dust cloud in his direction and sprayed him with gun pellets and curses. He rode unpursued until he reached the shelter of a fantastically splintered notch somewhere near the top of the ridge. Then he saw the white flicker of a laser cannon firing skyward again. In time, their target came into view. One of the bronze mini-hulls of the Light of Reason, detached in orbit and making its way into the atmosphere. Weaving and dodging in what was clearly an extremely complex pre-programmed pattern, it streaked away to the north. In the distance, Luke could see another thread-like flash of laser brightness. 5 or 6 kilometers away, he saw what looked like the outline of ruined walls, no doubt an old Grismath prison colony. Against the translucent rose of the surrounding ground, he saw the startlingly green splotches of what he had not yet seen in all this world. Vegetation. There was water down there somewhere. He put the craft into gear and headed down the canyon. As Luke maneuvered the speeder, it sagged lower and lower and finally settled to the canyon floor. The silence was huge, like the desert silences of Tatooine. Then behind him, he heard a soft crackling and felt electricity stab the air. Turning, he saw lightning racing down the face of the cliffs like skeletal hands. He watched, fascinated, as it poured down the face of the cliffs. As it came closer, he put his mind into the Force and raised the speeder in which he sat a few feet above the ground. The lightning poured under it, jarring him even through the speeder's insulation with mild jolts of pain. At the same time, he could feel the Force like a roaring in his mind. When the storm, whatever it was, had gone past, he let the speeder ease to the ground and stood up on it, watching the sparkling flood race down the rocks to the open plain. The planet is without life, he thought, except for scraps of vegetation and tiny enclaves of human habitation. But the Force was here. Luke dug his canteen from the speeder and the blaster he'd found along with a pair of macro binoculars under the seat and started down the canyon on foot. He sensed a human presence moments before his eyes picked out the dull metal of another speeder concealed in the shadows of a broken foundation. The owner sat in the dappled shade of a Balcrabian plant near a long ruptured pump that dribbled a series of tiny pools along the broken pavement. A young man, 6 or 7 years Luke's junior, Corellian, or maybe Alderaan's stock, to judge by the brown hair, the medium build. He grinned at Luke.
Where'd you drop out of, brother? Don't tell me you're on that B-wing they brought down.
Luke grinned back ingenuously.
I just want the name of the guy who said B-wings were too small to draw their fire, that's all.
Owen Lars, he introduced to himself, holding out his hand. The young man rose.
Arvid Scraff. Something the size of a B-wing usually can get through the automatics. The Therans must have been in the base when the sensors picked you up.
Luke dipped his canteen in the water.
That's my luck. I once picked up a half a crate of glitter stem for 2,500 credits, only the guy who sold it to me forgot to tell me he'd stolen it, and it had sensor relays in it. I hadn't even cleared the atmosphere when I had 14 revenue cruisers around me like buzzflies on a ripe fruit.
It hadn't happened to him, but to Han, and it gave him credentials of a sort and a persona. More than that, it let him size up Arvid Scraff for a few moments more.
Arvid picked up his own canteen. I'll help you haul whatever's left of your ship into Ruby Gulch. You can get cash for it there.
The anemic sun was sinking fast, and harsh wind pounded them out of the west. As they were wrestling ropes to tie Luke's borrowed landspeeder to Arvid's, Luke felt something scratch on his leg. Reaching down, he pinched off a tiny insect that had begun to burrow into his flesh.
Arvid tied down a final knot and clambered over the tail fins to Luke's side. Don't waste your time on them. They're kind of gross, but they just die and get absorbed. Hell, there's stories of crystal hunters who run out of food in the barrens and stick their hands into holes so they can absorb enough drox to get energy to make it to a settlement. Not something I'd care to do myself.
He made a face.
Drox? Arvid nodded. They're everywhere. Everybody has bites. Sunlight kills them. You just keep as clean as you can and don't worry about it.
Virtually nothing remained of the B-wing. Scuff marks, charring. Even the massive cylinder of the reactor was gone.
Didn't think we'd find much. Around here, everything's salvaged and sold before you can blink an eye.
A childhood on Tatooine had made Luke familiar with the economy of salvage. Conditions had been severe enough on his desert home planet, which had an open trade of sorts through Mos Eisley. On Nam Corios, a planet with virtually no natural resources and little access to imported goods, that much metal and microchips was a treasure trove. Arvid scuffed with his toe at the cracked corner of what had been a console housing.
You can stay with me at my aunt's in Ruby Gulch tonight. Aunt Jen will give you a top price for the speeder, too, if you want to sell. And that should be enough to get you a launch off planet when you get to Hueg Shul.
For the next hour and a half, Arvid fought the evening wind across the seafloor plains by the light of a couple of wavery chemical lamps. Against the darkness, far-off light speared the sky. Luke stared.
What the... Looks like an attack on the Bleak Point gun station. There's a couple of rifles under the seat, Owen, if you'd be so kind.
Luke fished out a Sinar proton blaster and a venerable Mersan Standard 4.
You take the proton,
offered Arvid generously as he tromped the accelerator.
You'd probably better.
The geriatric Sinar had been refitted repeatedly like every other piece of equipment Luke had seen on the planet. The gun station was a squat, dark complex of permacrete shapes seemingly fused into the black shoulder bones of the hills. The upper works of the station, where the cannon's gleaming black snout pointed at the sky, were crowned with a ragged, thorny palisade of projecting buttonwood poles, planks, and what looked like the twisted trunks of scrub locs, pointing like spears in all directions and strung with catwalks. A little band of attackers ran back and forth along the bastion, firing up into the superstructure with hard, clear bursts of proton light. Arvid put the macro binoculars to his eyes.
Yep, that's Gurney Caslow. He's one of the biggest water sellers between here and Hueg Shul. Without him, we'd never gotten those old pump stations going again. See that gal there with the white hair? That's Yamali Darm. She ships out spook crystals, the long green and violet kind you find in clusters up in the deep hills. They make some kind of optical equipment that's supposed to make flowers grow better on worlds with K-class suns or something.
She be the one to ask about getting yourself on a ship.